The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Good evening, and welcome to The Business of Giving. I'm your host, Denver Frederick, and it's nice to have you along on this first Sunday of summer. We're going to begin tonight by dissecting social movements. Why do some work and others don't? Is it simply timing and where society is ready to go, or is it more than that? We'll discuss this with Leslie Crutchfield, who has just come out with a new book entitled How Change Happens, Why Some Social Movements Succeed While Others Don't. And as you will hear, one of the things that is vital to a successful social movement is local grassroots support.
President Obama had a very good saying after the Supreme Court passed the marriage equality ruling in 2015. And he did say love is love, but he also said change comes to Washington, not from Washington.
Yeah.
And you got to have
great
big,
point.
Robust grassroots to achieve that kind of change.
And then you will hear from Maria Mottola, the executive director of the New York Foundation, one of the oldest and most highly regarded foundations in the country.
And this idea that people who are good at making money are somehow good at solving social problems. And our trustees had a different point of view, I think, and the values even then that I think have carried forward to today have to do with really listening to people who have some direct experience with the problems that are trying to be solved.
But first, the Business of Giving News Digest for Sunday, June 24th. By paring or eliminating tax incentives for charitable giving, the 2017 Tax Cuts and Jobs Act signed into law in December could reduce individual giving this year by as much as $17.2 billion, a report from the American Enterprise Institute finds. Over one-third of Americans take at least one prescription drug that lists depression as a potential side effect, a new study reports, and users of such drugs have higher rates of depression than those who don't take such drugs. Some of New York City's most prestigious private girls' schools have begun opening their doors to transgender students. The Brearley School on Manhattan's Upper East Side announced on Monday that all applicants who consider themselves female are welcome to apply, and if students no longer identify as female after they enroll, they can continue on at the school. And finally, the Kate Spade New York Foundation has pledged to donate more than $1 million to suicide prevention groups in memory of fashion designer Kate Spade, who died by suicide earlier this month. The foundation specifically promised to give $250,000 to the Crisis Text Line, which provides free crisis support 24 hours a day. It will also match donations from the general public to the nonprofit text service through June 29th, up to a total of $100,000. And that is the Business of Giving News Digest for this Sunday evening. I'll be back to speak with Leslie Crutchfield right after this.
Before you give to charity, go to charitynavigator.org. Charity Navigator provides free ratings of thousands of America's largest charities, helping you get the most out of your charitable dollar. Charitynavigator.org, your guide to intelligent giving.
If you're interested in reading transcripts of guests' interviews from The Business of Giving, you can find them at denverfrederick.wordpress.com. And now back to the show on AM 970, The Answer.
There's a lot in the news these days about social movements, such as Me Too, Never Again, and a number of others. Have you ever wondered if there were certain patterns or practices to these movements which will ultimately help determine how successful they will be? Well, it turns out there are, and they have been chronicled in a wonderful new book entitled How Change Happens While Some Social Movements Succeed While Others Don't. And it's a pleasure to have with us Leslie Crutchfield, its author, who also serves as the executive director of the Global Social Enterprise Initiative at Georgetown University's McDonough School of Business. Good evening, Leslie, and welcome to The Business of Giving.
Thank you for having me.
Well, what wonderful timing for a book like this to come out. I read your previous book, Forces for Good, and in it, you stated that the best organizations created movements, not just organizations. Was that a jumping off point for you to get started with How Change Happens?
That was exactly the inspiration for this new book on why some movements succeed and others don't. We knew that what made great nonprofits great from our study in Forces for Good, nonprofits like Teach for America, Habitat for Humanity, Environmental Defense Fund, and many others, the distinguishing factor was that they were all about driving for these larger causes. With Habitat for Humanity, it wasn't just about building houses. It was, how do we make poverty housing politically, economically, and religiously unacceptable in this world? So they had these big, hairy, audacious goals, as Jim Collins would call it.
Yep.
And so we knew movements distinguish high-impact organizations from others. And then this question kept rattling around in the back of my head, what makes a great movement? And so that's what led to this recent study, which we've been engaged with over the last several years to try and tease out the answers.
And what was the general time frame you looked at and researched when identifying successful and not so successful movements for this book?
We specifically looked in the modern era, so changes that have happened since the turn of the 21st century. So even though many of the movements we studied might have had a long tail, have been going on for decades, we wanted to understand, how do you get to a tipping point in the 2010s, right? So we looked at movements like the ones that led to the massive abandonment of smoking in this country. Smoking rates are now down to 15% for adults, under 6% for youth. We looked at gay marriage equality. And we looked at the gun rights movement. At the same time, we looked at movements during the same era that weren't successful or might be stuck, or in some cases are just emerging, like the movement for Black Lives and other newer movements. And we were trying to figure out, what's the delta? Why do some get that tipping point and others don't?
Well, in the book, you identify six practices of successful social movements. So let's run through each of them, starting with turn grassroots gold. And when I read that, you know, it reminded me of Tip O'Neill saying that all politics is local. And this just might be the most important recommendation that you make. What did you find out?
It is the most important recommendation, and that's in fact why it's the first chapter in the book. It might seem obvious. Of course, every movement, you know, has grassroots activism, protests, demonstrations, voter turnout. So it was really surprising to me and my colleagues at Georgetown University, who are working with me on the research, that some movements just don't master this. They might have a grassroots, but they don't invest in it. And that means real money, time, resources, amplifying and nurturing the grassroots and realizing that change happens from the bottom up. You know, President Obama had a very good saying after the Supreme Court passed the marriage equality ruling in 2015. And he did say love is love, but he also said change comes to Washington, not from Washington. And you got to have robust grassroots to achieve that kind of change.
Good example of that would be the NRA, correct?
The single most important factor, which explains why the gun laws are the way they are in the U.S. today, is exactly because of this point. It's the way the NRA and gun rights movement leaders have mobilized, organized, and amplified their grassroots. So while it might look like an even competition if you just were an average person watching the mainstream media coverage of the gun control movement and the gun rights movement, in fact, the media is pretty biased to the left.
Yeah.
The reality is that the gun rights movement since the 1990s has dramatically expanded to the point where they dwarf the gun control movement if you're just looking at the grassroots measure. So let's use 2012 as an example. That was the year of the Sandy Hook shooting massacre. And we all remember what happened in Newtown with the 26 students and educators that were killed that day. At that time, the NRA had already built up to nearly 5 million members, whereas the biggest gun control group at the time, Brady, was about 500,000. So the gun control movement at the grassroots was one-tenth the size of the gun rights movement.
Interesting.
So everybody says, well, why after Sandy Hook, if they couldn't have gotten a law passed, if we couldn't have got anything done, what would it take? What could be more horrible than that? And it's a great question. What's changed is that since then, the gun violence prevention side of the equation has really mobilized and ramped up. So after the Sandy Hook school shooting, Shannon Watts, a mother of four in Indiana, put together Moms Demand Action, started a Facebook page. That merged up with Mayor Bloomberg's Mayors Against Illegal Guns, and in 2014 created Every Town for Gun Safety. Now, at the time I finished my research last fall, Every Town was up to about 4 million supporters. Post Parkland, they're ready to tip past 5 million. So for the first time in 2018, you have a gun control movement that's equal in volume and intensity at the grassroots level, matching the power of the NRA.
So you got a fair fight for the first time. It should be interesting to see what happens. You know, another example, which I don't think we think of very often, is polio. Because when we think about polio, we think about the World Health Organization and we think about the Gates Foundation. But actually, there was a lot of on-the-ground support for that as well.
Exactly right. The reason why we are this close to eradicating polio from the face of the earth, we have put it out of business and 99.9% of the populations on earth, is because of Rotary International and its 33,000 chapters and its millions of boots on the ground in every country. In fact, when I was interviewing Bruce Aylward, the intrepid director of the Global Polio Eradication Initiative for decades, he says that he and Bill Gates and their staff will never take a meeting anywhere in the world without a Rotarian by their side, because they realize that the boots on the ground grassroots aspect of Rotary's network is what drives the political and social will in these countries to make polio eradication a priority. And that's what you really need. You can telescope it up globally on a cause like polio, or you could telescope it down into your state or city and think about how you can mobilize the grassroots against the cause.
The second practice you cite was to sharpen your 10, 10, 10, 20 equals 50 vision, which, if I dare say, was quite eye-opening for me. And you really captured this by describing what the LGBT community did. Share that with us.
Well, certainly the 10, 10, 10, 20 equals 50 vision is a tongue twister. It actually comes straight out of the playbook of the marriage equality movement and the LGBT activism to have same-sex marriage recognized in this country. And the origins really have a story behind them that happened right here in the New York vicinity where we're speaking. In 2005, the leaders of the marriage equality movement gathered in a conference room in Jersey City, New Jersey. They'd been brought together at the invitation of Tim Gill, a mega donor involved with this cause. And at this moment in time, LGBT marriage equality movement did not look like success was going to be inevitable. It actually looked impossible.
Yeah.
So you had DOMA. President Clinton had signed a law defining marriage as only between a man and a woman. 13 states had ballot referendums underway to ban gay marriage. Many other states already had laws in place. The only place where it was legal for a gay person to marry was Massachusetts. Even in Massachusetts, there was a vociferous opposition underway with Mitt Romney, leaders of the Catholic Church, organizing to try and repeal the marriage law that had been put in place. So the movement was on the rocks. And kind of in desperation, the leaders were meeting Evan Wolfson from Freedom to Marry, Mary Bonato, a very famous lawyer in this movement, others, Matt Coles from the ACLU. And they said, well, let's just do a thought experiment. What if we broke down the country and we said, let's take 10 states and see if we could actually get full marriage in those states. And we'll take 10 states and just go for civil unions. And another 10 states, let's see if we could even just get domestic relationship recognition laws in place. You know, these things are separate and unequal, but they're better than what we've got. And then in the balance of the states, 20 or more, let's just try and get the discriminatory laws off the books. So the idea was if you could get each state to sort of take one incremental step forward from wherever it was starting from, you would get this groundswell of momentum behind and support for marriage equality. And that's what they did. After that meeting, they divided up the country and each part of the movement could sort of work on what they wanted to work on in those states. And ultimately, they succeeded.
They sure did. This is the beauty of the 10th Amendment.
Well, in fact, we hear a lot about the First Amendment these days and seeing students exercising their right to protest in support of tighter gun laws. And of course, we hear a lot about the Second Amendment these days as well. But it really is the 10th Amendment that defines which way the policy pendulum will swing. And movements that figure out the 10th Amendment, of course, is the one that grants the majority of rights to the states and reserves a very small amount of federal power. If you recognize that and you drive your movement to achieve change at the state and local level first, you're much more likely to win. The other thing is, you know, think about it. For as successful as the gun rights movement has been in the last several decades, have you ever seen a big gun rights march on Washington?
Never.
They don't do it. They don't march on the Capitol. They go to the state capitals.
Yeah,
they
right.
go to the city. They go to municipal
level.
They
know where the action is.
They know where the power lies, and they are very savvy at putting pressure where it will actually make a difference.
Your third practice is change hearts and policy, with a lot of emphasis on that word and. These are not mutually exclusive. Tell us how they work together.
The reason why we framed hearts and policy together is by default, if many movements are resource constrained, you know, you don't have a lot of money, you don't have a lot of time, you say, well, let's just try and go for these policy changes, right? We'll open an office in D.C., we'll lobby, we can get meetings, you know, with representatives. But it's actually changing hearts minds, opinions, attitudes, behaviors that goes hand in hand with changing the policies so that when the laws change, people believe that those laws are the right way to go. And the other thing is when movements are focused on changing people's views and opinions about an issue, you've got to come at it head on. So let's take, for instance, out of the tobacco control movement. Now, no other modern movement has saved more lives or prevented more disease and suffering than the tobacco control movement. What they came up against was the realization that while they could put taxes on cigarettes and try and, you know, depress the buying and use of cigarettes that way, they realized that the ultimate opposition here wasn't just Philip Morris and the tobacco companies. It was Marlboro Man, Joe Camel. You know, there's a stat that at one point, Joe Camel name recognition was greater than Santa Claus in some poor children's communities.
That's so frightening.
It's very frightening. So they realize they're up against these iconic brands, Marlboro Man, Joe Camel, and their beloved. People identified themselves by what they smoke.
Mm-hmm.
The smoking was ubiquitous. It was frequent. It was fashionable. It was in the movies. It was in the magazines, even in hospitals. You know, you all can remember doctors and nurses smoking. So these, or you just have to watch one episode of Mad Men to recall, you know, how ubiquitous smoking was. So tobacco control realized we've got to make smoking as uncool as the spin masters out of Madison Avenue working for the tobacco companies were making it cool. And so that's what they did. Some of the most effective campaigns out of the tobacco control movement are from the Truth Initiative. These were targeted at young people originally at Gen X, who, you know, a couple decades ago were the millennials of their era, or I should say our era, being a Gen Xer myself.
Mm-hmm.
And tobacco control advocates were very keen and savvy. They said, what defines the Gen X psyche? Well, we're slackers. We're apathetic. We don't care. It was grunge. It was Seattle, right, at the time. And they said, okay, so if you want to appeal to Gen Xers, you've got to get into that rebellious spirit. So the ads and the media campaigns at the time were all targeted around, well, corporate leaders and the tobacco industry are these guys in suits, and they're trying to manipulate you and hook you into smoking. So if you really want to be rebellious, rebel against the man and don't smoke.
Mm-hmm.
And that worked. There's a lot of evidence out of the first campaigns in Florida that
right.
showed attitudes and opinions really shifting among young people around smoking. Today, the Truth has done research into millennials and next gen young people, and they less about rebellion for a rebellious sake, more about they really care about social justice. So you'll see ads this year around the Super Bowl about racial profiling and why cigarette companies are putting menthol and promoting that. Of all the African-Americans that continue to smoke, the majority choose menthol.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a very targeted and, frankly, racist approach. So how do you tackle it that way? Or you have, you know, on YouTube, Catmageddon, these silly cat videos that have gone viral.
That was good.
It was a great video.
It really is.
You know, the punchline is, if you smoke, secondhand smoke can kill your pets, no stupid cat videos. It got right at what tweens care about,
mm-hmm.
which is their pets and watching silly pet videos on YouTube. You know, and the beauty of it is it didn't say don't smoke. It wasn't one of these boring, you know, kind of traditional PSAs saying smoking's bad for you. It was savvy and modern and clever, and it works.
Yeah.
And that's the most important thing.
Quite hip. Fourth is reckon with adversarial allies. And boy, I found this to be such well-grounded advice and a reality check, because people and organizations working on the same cause are not always pulling in the same direction. Tell us about that.
Whether your cause is winning and triumphant or struggling to succeed, every cause and every movement has internecine warfare. You've got internal strife. You've got nonprofits and individuals fighting over money, credit, power, authority. Who gets to be the one to open up the, you know, speeches on the protest march? Who's going to testify before Congress? You know, I heard stories in different movements, winning and losing movements, of big gorillas in the field calling major donors and telling them to pull the grant of the other organization. just really
yeah.
crazy stuff.
Yeah, right.
And the stakes are high in all of these movements. So there's no secret sauce. There's no recipe that will show you the five action steps to overcome strife in your movement. I think what we found was that winning movements like marriage equality, like tobacco control, even gun rights, were able to find enough common ground among their disparate members to move forward. And going back to the idea of the 10-10-10-20 equals 50 strategy, that actually turned out to be a beautiful way to overcome some of the internal strife in the LGBT marriage equality movement. Because going back to that meeting in Jersey City, New Jersey in 2005, you know, one of the reasons the movement was on the rope was that they were all in conflict with each other. There was a camp of LGBT advocates that wanted to go for full marriage, right? Mm-hmm. And then there was another camp that said, why do we even want marriage? Why do we want to be like straight people? It's too traditional. It's too mainstream. We need to go our own way. We're queer. And then there was a camp that said, why are we trying to go for marriage? I just want to have my partner recognized so that I can visit them in the hospital if they're sick, right? So you had this extreme diversity of opinions from, you know, far left to far right and everything in between. So the beauty of having that 10-10-10-20 strategy was, if you wanted to just get discriminatory laws off the books, go for it. If you want to go for full marriage, go for that. It gave you everybody an ability to do what they thought was right, all generally pulling in the same direction, but not necessarily having to sing the exact same tune. They were in harmony, but not all singing the melody, if that makes sense.
It does. The classic big tent is what they were able to create. Fifth factor is break from business as usual. And this addresses the role that business, who sometimes is looked upon as being adversarial, but they have really played an important role in some of these successful movements. Tell us about a few of them.
Certainly the counterintuitive role in business was one of the big ahas that came out of our research. You know, we came in with the frame that many people hold, which is, you know, activist digging in their heels and protesting corporate wrongdoing. And certainly that was the case in the tobacco control and the tobacco wars over the last several decades. But in most of the movements, we started to say, well, what role did business play if you didn't have a powerful industry opponent? Mm-hmm. For instance, with gay marriage, there was no entrenched economic interest that stood to lose ground if society granted this right. So, you know, we saw business actually being a playing field for these changes to take place. So, for instance, with LGBT marriage, you know, one of the dedicated strategies early on was in the state of California. Advocates from ACLU and other organizations were working to get relationship recognition laws, getting companies to recognize same-sex partners on their benefit rolls. LGBT affinity groups within big corporations, entertainment, finance, tech industry players out in California were advocating from the inside, so that by the time the state of California was voting to reinstate gay marriage, of course, California had allowed gay marriage, then they had a backlash and they banned it, and then they were voting whether or not to reinstate it. At that point, 80% of people working in California already received benefits if they so desired. So the norm had shifted in California because the businesses had changed their corporate policies. And that led to these larger norm shifts, right? The default was, sure, we recognize same-sex partners. That's what we do, rather than that being a fringe or minority part of business. We saw in every movement the business is playing a role. And now, of course, you're seeing it more and more in this post-Parkland era after the shooting tragedy in Parkland, Florida. Pretty soon after that, you saw big businesses like Walmart's, Dick's Sporting Goods, dropping assault weapon sales from their shelves, raising the age voluntarily at which young people could purchase a gun. Bank of America announcing that it was going to no longer lend to companies that manufacture firearms. So these are really big, bold steps, and they have repercussions. I mean, if you look, go back to the tobacco control movement, a few years ago, CVS Health elected to stop selling cigarettes, and it was embracing its shared value vision of becoming a health and wellness and beauty company. And instead of selling cigarettes and chew and all the stuff that comes along with it, they were moving into, you know, specialty pharmaceuticals, minute clinics, and all these things. When they stopped selling cigarettes, they lost $2 billion in sales.
I recall, yeah.
It was a big hit. Now, they have bounced back and actually more than made up in that revenue by focusing on the wellness side of the business. So did not come without a cost. But and a lot of times I'll be asked, you know, what should corporate leaders do? Should they weigh in on these things? And I think the best advice to whether you're in a corporate foundation or a strategy group and you're thinking about how to engage with movements is to think about, you know, does this fit in with a larger vision that you have for a company? And where are you trying to go? And if you're trying to embrace shared societal, environmental, economic value, and it fits in with a narrative that you're already building, then it's probably worth doing. If not, it's going to come across as inauthentic and potentially you'll get backlash.
That's right. Things need to be in alignment.
There were a couple other ways that were interesting insights into how businesses contributed to advancing or sometimes thwarting mm-hmm. movements. Certainly, companies also played a role as advocates and educators. You know, when it came time for the Supreme Court to hear arguments about the gay marriage case, at that point, hundreds of companies were signing on to Friends of the Court briefing, and these were, you know, everything from ConAgra to Xerox and everything in between, not just sort of elite liberal coastal yep. companies, but Heartland America mm-hmm. type of companies too, because they knew that this was something that their employees wanted, customers wanted, and often businesses are the bellwether, and it takes a while for public policy to catch up. Whereas it's kind of counterintuitive because you think of businesses being sort of conservative and sluggish and the last to come on board. Another way we saw business engaged in movements was certainly doing what they do best, which is making products and making a profit. So commercial technologies, Dicorette gum, 800 quit lines, you know, you can mm-hmm. these also contribute to the abandonment of smoking. They're certainly not a silver bullet, but it's part of the mix. And then that last but not least, the other big trend that happened during this era that we're looking at, really at the turn of the 21st century, is the way that businesses have become really hyper-exposed to media and consumer glare because of the advent of technologies, new media. You know, now, you know, in a single tweet, an individual can influence millions. And you saw this, for instance, when in the gun control debate, when a conservative pundit, Laura Ingraham, criticized David Hogg, one of the students from Parkland, about something. And he implored her advertisers to abandon her. And they dropped her like mm-hmm. a hot potato. That is the power of the internet equalizing and democratizing things. So this all started, you know, just in the last few decades. You also have all this extreme activism, right? Like Greenpeace volunteers started skydiving off of smokestacks and commandeering whaling ships, and these actions on the front line of a company's operations was different than sort of a little picket line around the, you know, sidewalk around a headquarters, right? Yeah. Like this was media friendly, great content, made great video. And so, you know, companies find themselves on the crosshairs very easily when they're doing stuff wrong. And so there's more impetus, I think, today to try and get on the right side of many of these causes.
Can't agree more. And the sixth and final practice is to be leaderful. And this is a little bit like the porridge and Goldilocks and the Three Bears. At least it was to me. Not too hot, not too cold, but just right. How is being leaderful just right?
Movements that are leaderful operate between two extremes. And on the one hand, on the far left, you have movements that are leaderless, right? They're chaotic. There's anarchy. There's no clear leadership. Remember Occupy Wall Street?
Actually, it's right downstairs, Zuccotti Square. We're about 100 yards from it.
Yes. So, you know, you had all of this protest and activism and the call for the 99%. And they purposely had a leaderless structure. Mm-hmm. It was purely democratic, no hierarchy. They had dozens of different demands. And what happened? You know, it got a lot of attention and flared bright and then kind of fizzled. Oof. On the other extreme, you can have movements that are too leader-led, top-down, controlled by the elite institutions, often out of Washington, D.C. And leader-led movements tend to hoard power. They hoard credit. They're not pushing authority, responsibility, and limelight out to the grassroots and the chapters at the state and local level. They're keeping it to themselves. And what you want to find is a balance between those two, where your base of power is still coming from the grassroots, but the grass tops mm-hmm. is really providing direction rather than commands. And I think of it as the leaderful movements have leaders who really are playing the role of a conductor of an orchestra, trying to get all of the different actors out there to play in tune rather than the commander of a military unit or a traditional CEO.
Yeah. And Mothers Against Drunk Driving would be a good example of that, correct?
Mothers Against Drunk Driving is a great example. In fact, there's a terrific quote from Candy Leitner, the founder of MAD, who says, as she was starting all these chapters and the organization was growing like wildfire across the country, her advice to any movement leader and advocate is this: never open an office in Washington, D.C. And she, you know, MAD started out in California, then they moved their headquarters to Texas, Texas and yeah. where they still are. But the power has always been out across the land with local and state organizations. The other thing is leaderful movements really put the people with the lived experience of the problem front and center. So whether you're a victim or a survivor of a drunk driving crash or, you know, any of the issues that we're talking about, those people that have that lived experience are the best and most passionate and articulate spokespeople. So pushing that credit authority limelight out builds momentum. And it also keeps you from getting suffocated from the top down.
Mm-hmm. Very smart. Were you surprised, Leslie, by anything you found, or perhaps more to the point, things that you did not find as being critical to a successful social movement?
One frame that we did this research, one frame that we used while doing the research was kind of traditional social movement theory, right? And a lot's been written about civil rights era movements, scholars coming out of the 60s and 70s. There's also a lot of great social movement scholarship that's come out since then. But the frame is around the mental model that we hold is kind of contentious collective action, right? It's protests, it's demonstrations, it's angry mobs of activists. And while sometimes contentious protest was part of movements that we studied, a lot of times it wasn't. The movement to eradicate polio certainly has been arduous. It has required enormous resources, efforts, and sacrifice, but it hasn't involved protests, right? And the nature of that issue doesn't necessarily lend itself to that. So that was one thing. The other thing, I think the timing of this book has been really fortuitous. You know, we started writing it in 2014, long before the populist movement that resulted in the election of Donald Trump. I believe that in many ways, that populist movement and Trump's ascension to power has been the anvil upon which many of today's movements are being forged.
Mm-hmm.
When you look at Me Too, what's coming out of Parkland and Never Again, the teachers that are out protesting, not for their own pay raises, but for a raise for all the kids that they teach, the gymnasts that are banding together against that pedophile coach that was preying on them for years. There's something today about the power of collective action. Individuals who individually are pretty powerless, and only by linking arms and together commonly advocating on a purpose do you see the balance of power shifting. And I think a real bellwether of that is the Fortune magazine rankings are out this month, the 50 greatest world leaders list. And for the first time since Fortune's done those rankings, it's not a CEO at the top or a president of a country. It's the students from Marjorie Douglas Stoneman High School.
Mm-hmm.
The number three slot is Me Too. There's movement sprinkled across that. That shows just how important collective leadership models have become in this day and age.
So in gathering all this research and interviewing countless people, were you able to identify some essential truths about how change happens?
A few fundamental truths really crystallized for me and my team, and I worked very closely with Bill Novelli, the founder of the Global Social Enterprise Initiative, which I work at Georgetown in the business school.
And the Campaign for Tobacco-Free Kids.
Bill was the founding president of Campaign for Tobacco-Free Kids. He was CEO of AARP. He founded Porter Novelli, the global communications firm. So he's had a lot of experience on the ground, and I spent several years studying this stuff. And we came to three conclusions. First, change is possible. Even in the face of seemingly insurmountable odds and powerful industry opponents, you see movements winning. And you also see movements not winning.
Mm-hmm.
But the point being that it's possible to change things, especially in this day and age. The second insight is that change is nonpartisan. You know, with the gun rights movement success, you got Tea Party, libertarians, conservatives winning the day. But on other causes like LGBT marriage, tobacco control, liberals, progressives, they're winning. It's not one party or even one faith that rules at the end of the day. You know, God doesn't appear to be on any one side of these causes. And if multiple gods were involved, there clearly is not consensus. The third point is this. Change is deliberate. At the end of the day, social change making is an act of leadership. These changes did not happen by chance. Smoking did not go out of fashion. We didn't just grant marriage equality to LGBT community members because it seemed like the right thing to do. And gun rights have not become so expanded and gun laws so lenient in the U.S. by chance. These were deliberate acts of well-led, well-organized movements. And the other point that was fascinating is that the leaders of these movements, while they were leaderful, they also were just kind of everyday people. You know, the drunk driving movement founded by Candy Leitner was created by somebody who was a real estate agent and a mom of two kids. Many of the leaders of these movements, their backgrounds would not portend that they would go on to have so much impact in society. Some were lobbyists and politicians and had some skills in that area and training, but most weren't. And it belies the fact that truly anyone can lead if you have the gumption and the passion and the relentless pursuit of impact. And it's not preordained who's going to lead these things.
We as individuals can really make a difference. Well, Leslie Crutchfield, the author of How Change Happens, Why Some Social Movements Succeed While Others Don't. I want to thank you so much for being here this evening. Now, the book has a website, correct? Tell us about it, what's on it, and where people can go and get the book.
HowChangeHappens.com. It's got all the good media and commentary that we've done, where to buy the book. But really, anywhere that books are sold, you can get the book. And the ideas in it really are to help any individual, whether you lead a nonprofit, whether you just donate to a movement, whether you are a target of a movement. We hope that these ideas can help you advance your cause.
Well, I bought it, I read it, and I got an awful lot out of it. Thanks, Leslie. It was a real pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you for having me.
I'll be back with more of The Business of Giving right after this.
Recruit the best talent. Explore the untapped pool of 24 million productive Americans with disabilities. The National Organization on Disability is the leading partner to help companies succeed in disability employment. Learn more at NOD.org.
Welcome back to The Business of Giving with Denver Frederick.
It has been written about the New York Foundation that they are the Sugar Ray Robinson of philanthropy, pound for pound, the best grant maker in the business. Their vision, integrity, and willingness to take risks are matched by very few others, if any. Maria Mottola has served as their executive director since 2003 and has been with them since 1994. But she's with us now. Good evening, Maria, and welcome to The Business of Giving.
Thank you.
The history of the foundation is so rich. It's really breathtaking. And although you now solely focus on New York, there was a time that that wasn't the case. Share with our listeners some of the history of the New York Foundation.
Sure. The New York Foundation was founded in 1909. At the time the foundation was created, there were very few other foundations in existence that were grant-making organizations. So in a way, the trustees didn't have any blueprint for how philanthropy should work. The two original donors were the Heinsheimer brothers. They made their money mostly in banking and real estate.
Mm-hmm.
They were German Jewish immigrants who were sort of part of a, I want to say a club, but they had, you know, I think one of the things we learned at our 100th year was the lots of connections in that community at that time. So a lot of the folks who served on settlement house boards or in other kinds of reform, social reform organizations were contemporaries and colleagues of our original donors. They did start the foundation with a focus on New York. They, you know, when the early trustees were thinking about the work, they really had in their mind, I think, this idea that they wanted to support organizations that were informed by people who were living in those neighborhoods or working in those communities. You know, the early foundation grants were, I think, pretty different than they would have been for other similar foundations at that time. So they, you know, one of the very first grants that the foundation made was to the NAACP, mm-hmm. which was itself a new organization at that time. Shortly after that, the Urban League, other organizations that were very risky startups in the early 1900s, but are now organizations that, of course, are more established. And we know some of this because in about somewhere in the 1940s, the trustees put together a history, like a little history. So we have some inkling of how they thought about the work in the earliest days. And I think, you know, the themes that you referenced in the beginning were themes even back then. They mm-hmm. they talked about this idea of wanting to take risks. They described themselves as venture capitalists who sort of felt that the same way that they would look for opportunities on the finance side, that they would think about the grant making in a similar way. So yeah, so there's, and I think we have mostly focused on New York City this entire time. So for more than 100 years, there's a period of time in the late 50s, early 60s, where the board recognized that for civil rights to be realized for African Americans, much of the focus was going to have to be on the South. And so you see in our grant making history, a whole list of grants that were made, you know, in those years to groups that were doing work.
Yeah,
I did civil rights work in
I
the
did
South.
Say that.
Yeah.
What is the foundation's view on the role of philanthropy in society, and how has that informed the work that you do and the grant making that you make?
Yeah, so, you know, again, I was really fortunate as a new director that the trustees had written about these things in different pivotal points of time. So the foundation had this kind of sense, I think, of itself as an outlier, even in the earliest days. So they write about in the 1940s about how the emergence of other big philanthropies, they felt they were critical of those philanthropies. They felt that they were, you know, building monuments to themselves, that, you know, this idea that people who are good at making money are somehow good at solving social problems. And our trustees had a different point of view, I think, and the values even then that I think have carried forward to today have to do with really listening to people who have some direct experience with the problems that are trying to be solved. And they really made a distinction, even in those early years, between direct charity or, you know, even philanthropic work that assumed that problems, you know, problem solving could be focused on sort of fixing individuals as though there was some, you know, there was some kind of pathology around being poor or, you know, you could simply, address somebody's, big social problems by, you know, focusing on individual people. And they really saw them as systemic and caused by bigger factors in society that made the city a place where not everybody could thrive and not everybody could go to a good school, that people couldn't work. So some of the early grants are really interesting because, you know, you have to look at them through, you know, an early 1900 lens.
Sure.
But even things, one that always strikes me as, you know, they made a grant to an organization that, you know, the title of it sounds very paternalistic. It's you know, something focused on shop girls and department store workers. And really what it was, you know, this kind of precinct organizing model where young women who worked in department stores would go and organize other young women who worked in department stores for better wages and better living conditions, you know, because they were very vulnerable in the 1900s, right? If they were single and living in New York and, you know, trying to earn their way through these service jobs, which is not that different than, say, a group like the Center for Frontline Work Retail, which we fund today, that works with, you know, predominantly people of color, young people who work in stores around the city and who get, you know, who get paid poor wages. And so I guess there's kind of a through line of values that I think I think what makes it a little different than other foundations is that they didn't have the impulse to reinvent themselves at different periods of time. They really, from the very beginning, defined their role as being responsive as opposed to directive or prescriptive. And so I think that the foundation was able to be supportive of small startup risky groups that reflected changes in New York that were happening or in real time, as opposed to, you know, sitting in a room somewhere deciding these are the three most important issues and now we're going to go fix them.
Yeah, that's a very admirable way to go about it. So often you see what happens is that when you get a new executive coming into a foundation, all of a sudden the priorities change and you say, well, really, did the world change that much since they assumed that position? As you said, they were always like venture capitalists and you are today. And that means that you invest in high-risk startup organizations, and many of those would have a hard time getting funding from other grant makers. What do you look for in these organizations, and how do you go about deciding which ones you're going to fund?
Yeah, I mean, so some of this sounds to me like common sense. I know that there are lots of buzzwords in the field about, especially now, about what to call this, but we still have an open application process. Mm-hmm. We take proposals. Groups don't have to wait to be invited. We have three deadlines a year. Any group can apply. We're very accessible. We'll talk to anybody who calls about what we're looking for. We actually read them all. We don't have any kind of eligibility quiz that screens, you know, folks out in some kind of algorithm. We have three program staff. I'm included in the program staff, and we read everything that comes in. And we look for where there's direct involvement on the part of people who are experiencing whatever the problem is that the group is trying to solve. So that's a factor. We look to see, are these groups that wouldn't otherwise have access to private philanthropy? So we're often the first, at least a formal foundation that might consider that group.
A real difference maker.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And we look for groups that have real roots in a neighborhood or within some consistency. If, you know, know, it might be day laborers, it might be, you know, nail salon workers, it might be a community of people who come here from another country and establish their place in a neighborhood, or it might be folks who've lived in a neighborhood for a long time. But really that idea of some connection, some deep connection to place or, you know, point of view. And that's important to us.
Yeah, it's a real belief that the people who are closest to the problem are probably closest to the solution as well.
Right,
and you really live that.
Yeah, so a colleague said on a panel I was on a couple weeks ago, a colleague said, put it this way, she said, problems and solutions live in the same place, which yeah. I thought was a great way to say it, and I wish I had thought of it myself.
I'll use it.
Yes.
Well, there's certainly a lot going on in the country right now, and in turn, the city in which we both live. What are some of the social movements and advocacy efforts that you're really looking at right now that are taking up your attention and energy at the moment?
So most of the groups that we support use community organizing and advocacy as an approach to their work. You know, somebody asked me after, you know, in this time, did we feel it was necessary to kind of pivot or adjust our strategy? We don't, because certainly our grantees have had to pivot and adjust and adapt, but in terms of our support, we feel like now more than ever, it's important for us to remain steadfast and to be a core supporter of the groups that can do this work. You know, our grantees have been on the front lines of a lot of the social activism that's occurred over the last year and a half.
Mm-hmm.
We've actually converted all of our grants, or most all of our grants, to general support to give them that flexibility to be responsive to what the current moment requires. You know, in terms of issue areas, since the beginning, the foundation resisted limiting the grant making to issue area focus because they felt very strongly that the issues had to bubble up from the community and they didn't want to box themselves in like some foundations do into certain program silos. So the foundation has been in a good position to respond, I think, in that we don't have those kinds of limitations. Anyway, so a lot of our grantees are working on immigrant rights. Many of them were in LaGuardia Airport last night mm-hmm. in a rapid response demonstration regarding family separation. We have groups that are working on racial equity, economic mobility, affordable housing. A lot of our groups are currently working on. So there's criminal justice is another big area of work. But these change as the opportunities change for groups that do this work around the city.
And your grants are like $45,000,
yeah,
somewhere in that neck of
the
woods.
Yeah.
One of the things you also provide to your grantees is an extensive capacity building program. What kind of support does that entail?
Yeah, so this grew out of the fact that we were funding so many startup groups. Our capacity building program is pretty old. I think it's almost 40 years old
mm-hmm.
now. So I think we probably were one of the first foundations to incorporate that into our grant making focus, at least that I know of. The idea was that, you know, startup groups really needed that kind of on-ramping, I guess. You know, so how do I, you know, we literally get calls from groups, how do we now open a bank account, you know, with this check you just sent? So how to get started, how to hire staff, how to set up a board, how to apply for your 501c3. And over the years, the capacity building field itself has grown, as you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's much larger, much more robust. I think when we first started the program, there weren't that many nonprofit capacity building providers even out there to support. We now actually do this work collaboratively with a set of other funder colleagues. We all realized that, you know, where we have grantees in common, it didn't make sense for them to have to pick and choose between our different capacity building programs.
Yep.
So we work with about 7 other foundations where there's overlap in our grantees and collaborate on workshops and things like that. But it's been a really, I was a grantee of the foundation myself before coming on staff, and the capacity building program was really instrumental in getting our group up and running. You know, just all kinds of basic things like budgeting and, you know, bylaws, and because we were also a startup.
Yeah. Let's turn our attention to Engage to Change, and that's an initiative you started several years back, and it focuses on client feedback versus participant engagement. Tell us about this effort.
Yeah, so we did, it was a partnership with the Building Movement Project, which is a national organization that has been working on these issues for years, trying to sort of help shift folks thinking about where, you know, civic engagement activities happen. They don't just happen in standalone organizations. They also can be very robust within a social service context. And that sometimes social service organizations are really the trusted entities in a community where people come together to engage with one another and as community members. And I think we were feeling, the New York Foundation, partly we were feeling pushed by some of our grantees to pay attention to this, that some of the most exciting community organizing was happening in places like settlement houses, soup kitchens, which most of our colleagues think of as purely direct service or human service organizations, you know, dealing with people's problems one-on-one. But in some of these places, the staff and board members were doing really important and creative work engaging their constituents in social change. So, you know, if you were a parent in the after-school program, you know, plugging you into efforts to make sure that the city budget for after-school wasn't going to be cut, or if you were a young person coming to the college access program to try to get help applying for college, that you could also be drawn into efforts to make sure that you know, your school had enough guidance counselors, that colleges had fair admissions processes, that kids weren't being suspended or expelled at high rates. You know, and we profiled a number of organizations. The one I think is sort of easiest to visualize is we funded Neighbors Together, which is a soup kitchen in Brownsville.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, you know, if you went to visit, you would say, oh, this is a soup kitchen. It's a wonderful soup kitchen, an amazing space. But what they really do that's distinctive, I think, is that they engage the people who come there in activism around economic equity,
mm-hmm.
right? So why, you're not just here as a recipient of service, but you are someone who has the power to engage around these issues that brought you here in the first place. And so our effort with Building Movement Project and the grantees that we worked with was to really highlight these kinds of stories, and both to encourage organizations to think about this, but really to encourage our funder colleagues, particularly those that primarily fund direct service, to recognize that this kind of work is on a continuum of work that any of their grantees might engage in.
You are really bottoms up. You really get there, and those people, and that's as opposed to so many foundations, which tend to look, as you know, from the ivory tower and determine what the problems are and what the solutions are. I know you're assisted in all this by your board
mm-hmm.
and the important role that they play. Tell us what they do to help guide and direct the activities of the foundation.
Yeah, so when you said that before about, you know, each new president comes in to a foundation and maybe has a slightly different point of view, I think one of the things that mitigates that at the New York Foundation is the board. I think the board had a strong commitment to including women and people of color on the board going
mm-hmm.
back to the 1920s. So I think that there's this sense when people join the board that, you know, they're part of a legacy, right? They're sort of a point on this historical line, that through line that of the New York Foundation values. So there isn't an impulse to necessarily to reinvent the foundation. It's more like an impulse to protect the legacy of something that has value in the city. And so I think even being a staff person, you come in with this sense of, I'm a shepherd of, you know, my role is to shepherd this organization for whatever amount of time in its history I'm going to be there. And the board is made up today primarily of people who are either former grantees or academics or people who have some stake in the kind of work that we fund or some expertise in the areas in which our grantees are working. And they are enormously helpful to the staff in helping us understand the landscape and what's going on.
Mm-hmm. Having been an executive director of a foundation for some 15 years now and having an impeccable track record, really, and have tremendous respect, I think, throughout the sector, what do you think foundations could do a little bit differently that would help them to become more effective?
I think we can all do more listening. I know lots of us say that we do, but I think there's always more. I think maintaining a certain level of agitation, curiosity, you know, sort of...
I like agitation.
Yeah, I mean, resisting, I think on my worst days are the days where I start to sort of settle into a sense of certitude about things, mm-hmm. you know, like we have it figured out. And then I know I'm in trouble because nobody has it figured out. So I feel like, you know, I try to maintain almost like a sense of surprise. We just had a conversation on staff yesterday about a group that the program officers went to see that was a high risk group we funded probably 15 years ago. And we really didn't think they were going to make it. And now, 15 years later, they are doing great. They're really rooted in the community. They just hired a new executive director. And I think surprise was this sort of the surprise joy of knowing that you don't have all the answers. And I think that's really hard in philanthropy. I think there's a lot of pressure to kind of explain away the uncertainty. I feel it myself, so I'm not saying anything I wouldn't say to myself on my worst days.
It's human nature. I mean, we want to justify what we've done.
Well, and we want, I think I've started to think of it as we want to rationalize what we can't do. In other words, you know, people don't realize until you get into the field that most of the time your job is to explain why you have to say no. And I think often our impulse to come up with boxes is really about, you know, trying to be wanting some level of comfort about saying why I'm saying yes to this and why I'm saying no to this, when sometimes, you know, the true answer is no particular reason except our lack of resources. And that's not about, you can't strategic plan your way out of that, I don't think.
Yeah.
I wish there was something.
Yeah, we don't like ambiguity. We like to be able to say this is a reason, whereas sometimes it's kind of goodness knows.
I think the other thing I would say is, and I do feel like this is maybe changing a bit, but, you know, the thing I take away from every conversation and every site visit with a grantee or a potential grantee is this incredible sense of urgency. And I don't feel the same thing when I'm with my colleagues. Again, I feel like that's maybe changed in the last few months. But, you know, philanthropy has the luxury. We have the luxury of taking our time.
Yeah.
And I just think that that disconnect between how our grantees have to function in the world and the way we're able to function in the world, I feel like that has to change.
That's a great point. I also sometimes think that urgency is one of the things that brings collaboration.
Mm-hmm.
When you feel it, you all want to work together because the problem becomes so large. Mm-hmm. When you don't feel it, you can go your own way a lot more easily. Let me close with this, Maria. You've been at the New York Foundation some 24 years. In that time, how has the nature of community organizing and advocacy changed? And what do you think is needed today in order to be effective in that realm?
Yeah, I mean, I feel very hopeful about how it's changed over time. I feel in the time that I've been doing this work, a real sense of its potency and its robustness, if that's even a word. You know, the groups that, you know, sure, we've funded many, many groups that have come and gone, that's for sure. But even in those cases, we've seen those leaders go on to either run for office, become neighborhood leaders in some other way, work for other organizations and become leaders there. That gives me a tremendous amount of hope. We're not necessarily looking for every grant we make to, you know, become a well-established nonprofit. If out of that work emerges strong leaders in the movement, that's a great thing. You know, so, and I think that it's way more sophisticated. People's understanding of the political landscape is much more sophisticated. Groups that we support have started C4s and have a whole political arm to their work that was not true in the past.
Mm-hmm.
Groups, I think they're less, you know, sure, there's still issues around, you know, who gets credit for what or who covers what area, but in general, I feel like the silos have broken down a lot, and the there's much more flexibility in terms of how groups work across issues that I think is a good thing for the field.
Well, Maria Mottola, the executive director of the New York Foundation, I want to thank you so much for being here this evening. You have a few interesting things up on your website. Tell us what they are.
So we have a website that is meant to be not just a place to find out what we do, but also to understand more what our grantees are doing. The point of it is to amplify their work. So we have terrific content where you can listen to grantees talk about what motivates them to do their work. We have a partnership with StoryCorps where grantees are interviewed. We also have resources for new nonprofits if people are looking for help. And we have a whole section on our history of the foundation for people interested in that. And then an important feature on the website is also we are anxious for people to know that our grantee leaders are experts in their field. And, you know, we feel like too often the same people are asked to comment on different issues around the city, and the same voices are heard. So we have a section of our website that functions as kind of a virtual speakers bureau, and I encourage people to take a look there to see, you know, who they might bring on a panel to talk about things that are important.
I think we could all use a few different perspectives, that's for sure. Well, thanks, Maria. It was a great pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you. It was fun.
And that is tonight's program. Next week will be all about the arts. And my guest will be Katie Clark, the president of the Brooklyn Academy of Music, known simply as BAM, and Kara Medoff-Barnett, the executive director of the American Ballet Theater. So be here for that if you can. Thanks for listening. Have a great week. And I hope you'll be back next Sunday evening for The Business of Giving.
The preceding program is paid for by the friends and partners of The Business of Giving.
3-star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.